This is how Michael Caine speaks. Michael Caine speaks to his nose like that. He gets very, very specific. It's very like that. When he gets loudly, it gets very loud indeed. She was only 16. You're only supposed to blow the bloody doors off. That's Michael Caine.
If you do a quick YouTube search, you can find lots of people doing Michael Caine impressions. And he says he doesn't mind at all.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. It's very funny. They always do my accent as a Cockney, you know, but thicker than my accent that I'm speaking to you now. This is just a London accent that you can understand. But they go, not many people know that. You know, that's the way impersonations go, you know. My name is Michael Caine. Not many people know that. That's my impersonation of me.
Michael Caine's voice is just one of those everyone knows and everyone loves. Think about it. Have you ever met anyone who isn't a Michael Caine fan? My parents loved him in Alfie and the Ipcress File and the Italian Job back in the 1960s. My teenage kids love him now in the Batman Dark Knight trilogy and in Kingsman, The Secret Service. And my own love kind of bridges the gap there with way too many to choose from. Sleuth, Educating Rita, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, Mona Lisa, The Cider House Rules. There's just something about that guy. And lucky you, he's about to regale you with fantastic stories about Elephant and Castle, the working-class London neighborhood where he grew up, and about the joys of acting well into one's 80s. Michael Caine is on this episode of What It Takes, a podcast about passion, vision, and perseverance from the Academy of Achievement. I'm Alice Winkler.
Adam A., this child is gifted. And I heard that enough that I started to believe it.
If you have the opportunity, not a perfect opportunity, and you don't take it, you may never have another chance.
It all was so clear. It was just like the picture started to form itself.
There was no way in which a lie could prevail over the truth. Darkness over light, death over life.
Every day I wake up and decide, today I'm going to love my life. Decide.
My advice is, if they're going to break your leg once when you go in that place, stay out of there.
And then along come these differential experiences that you don't look for, you don't plan for, but boy, you better not miss them.
Michael Caine has played a British imperialist, a con artist, a bank robber, an obstetrician, a Cockney Casanova, every manner of gangster, and butler to a certain caped superhero. But I can barely scratch the surface here because Michael Caine has been in over 150 movies and counting. He's 85 as I record this and recently finished filming three that are in post-production. Washington Post correspondent Mary Jordan traveled to London for the Academy of Achievement in November of 2018 for a wide-ranging conversation with Michael Caine at his apartment building overlooking the Thames.
You know, you're a hero to people over 70. When you turned 70 in March 2003, that was 15 years ago.
Yes.
And since then, you've done at least three dozen movies, and you said seven of your best.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So what's your message to people who are in their later years?
Be very careful about retiring because you don't know what's out there. What happened to me is I retired twice. I wrote two autobiographies, you know, and what happened to me was I was about 65 and I got a script from a producer and I sent it back. I said, the part's too small. He said, I didn't want you to read the lover. I wanted you to read the father. And I thought, oh, my God, it's over, because if you don't get the girl, you're no longer a movie star, you know? But what I didn't realise is that when you get older, you don't get the girl, you get the part. So you don't get to kiss the girl, you get the Academy Award. So, but I didn't know all that. I mean, I went to Miami. I started a whole new life for the winter, you know, and I bought an apartment there and a restaurant, and I was having a wonderful time. When Chris Nolan turned up with Batman.
Wow.
You know,
and tell me that story about when Christopher Nolan...
Christopher Nolan, it was one Sunday morning, my house in the country, and the front door is glass, and there was a man standing there with a script in his hand, And I answered it, and he said, I said, come in. And directly he said his name, I knew who he was, because he'd done three wonderful, very small movies, but artistic, very, you know, award-winning movies. And I thought, oh, this is wonderful. You know, I'll get something here. Might be an Academy Award or something. You know, it'd be a great part. So he said, I've got a script here for you. I said, what's it called? He said, Batman Begins. I said, Batman? He said, yeah, because this is a great big thing, you know, and this guy only made three little tiny movies. And I thought, my God, how did he get to do that, you know? And I thought myself, well, I'm too old to play Batman. I think I'm going to be the butler. So I said to Chris, I said, who am I going to be, the butler? He said, yeah, you're going to be the butler. So I said, oh, well, I said, what do I say? Dinner is served. Would you like another glass of red wine? Is that my dialogue? He said, no. He said, raise it. He said, because the butler was Batman's foster father because he died. He said, so he's much more important than that.
This house, Master Wayne, has sheltered six generations of your family.
Why do you give a damn, Alfred? It's not your family.
I give a damn because a good man once made me responsible for what was most precious to him in our world. Miss Dawes has offered to drive you to the hearing. She probably hopes to talk you out of going.
Should I just bury the past out there with my parents, Alfred?
I wouldn't presume to tell you what to do with your power, sir. Just know that there are those of us who care about what you do with your future.
You haven't given up on me yet.
Never.
How old were you then when Christopher Nolan came knocking?
About 72 or 73. And here I was starting a whole new career and then made six of the best movies with Chris Nolan I'd ever made. I got an Academy Award for Cider House Rules. And so, and for me, that was an incredible thing because there I was, I'd retired twice.
Jack Nicholson, Laurence Olivier, and Michael Caine are the only actors ever to be nominated in five different decades for an Academy Award.
Yeah, we've been, yeah, Jack and me and Larry, and we all work together, you know, we're friends. We were friends, you know, I mean, especially Jack. Because Jack, it's one of those things, you know, it's amazing. But Jack was the one, when I retired and went to Miami, I wasn't going to do another movie, and it was Jack who I met there. He was living there at that time. And then we became friends, and then one day he said, he said, I've got a script called Blood and Wine. There's a good part for you in it. I said, I'm retired, Jack. I'm over. He said, read it. And I read it, and it was great. And he was the one who brought me back to working because I hadn't worked for 2 years. And I was very happy in Miami with my restaurants and everything. And I came back, and that's what started this whole thing going again.
Why restaurants? When you you have many restaurants now. Why restaurants?
Oh, I love restaurants. Yeah, I love owning restaurants. I used to own several.
But they're hard work. Why do you like that?
I know they're hard work, but I liked it. And the hard work is the chefs. They're more temperamental than actors. I had a restaurant where Marco Pierre White was the chef, and the sous chef was Gordon Ramsay.
You're a good cook too, right?
Yeah, I'm a very good cook. My mother was a cook, and so I was always in kitchens mucking about and watching what she was doing. And it's one of those things. Also, I like writing, and I like gardening, and I like cooking. What do they have in common, those three things? All those three things have in common is you do them on your own. You don't need anybody else to help you. You don't need any conversation. You don't need any advice. You just get on with it on your own. As opposed to the movies where there's 300 people working with you all day, every day.
That's so interesting because of all people in Hollywood, you have so many friends in Hollywood. You know all the biggest names.
Oh, blimey. Yeah. We lived in Hollywood for 10 years. And my wife is a fabulous woman and everybody loved her. It wasn't me, it was her that she made our social life.
You've been married almost 50 years, which is almost unheard of in Hollywood. What's the secret there?
I just think it's just love, that's all. It's just true love. We just happen to love each other so much, you know? And we're devoted to each other. And we never spend any time apart. I had an experience recently. My wife's mother, who lives in New York, was not very well. And my wife flew to New York for 4 days to see her. And that was the first time I'd been separated from my wife in 46 years. I'd never been on my own, ever. But I was very lucky because I have an older daughter and she spent the time with me.
So you've only been apart about 4 days?
In 47 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
How'd you meet her?
Well, I was with my best male friend and we were going out every night to discotheques, you know, getting bombed out of our minds and chasing girls and all that. And then one night I said, let's do something we never do, watch television. We'll stay in. And I'm a good cook and he knew I was a good cook. I said, I'll cook dinner and we'll just watch the television. So we watched the television. It wasn't very good. And then an advert came on for Maxwell House Coffee and a Brazilian girl, a dark Brazilian girl was in it. And I fell in love with this girl on the television. And I thought, well, I said, and I had some money. I was working, you know, I was already a star in movies. And so I had plenty of money. And I said to my mate, I said, we'll go to Brazil in the morning. I said, we'll find her. I've got to find this girl. And then we got sort of restless. He said, well, there was a discotheque. You know, we went to this discotheque, you know, and with my best friend owned it, you know, called Tramp. And Johnny Gold owned it. And I said, let's go down and have a drink with Johnny. I got all excited. I didn't want to go to bed. And we were sitting there. And another man came in and he said, oh, hello, you three sitting there, no girls, what's going on? And I said, no, I said, I just came out for a drink. I said, I'm going to Brazil tomorrow. He said, what for? I said, well, I've seen this girl on television. She's Brazilian. I said, and she's beautiful and I'm in love with her and I'm going to find her. He said, I've been watching television all evening. I didn't see any beautiful girls. I said, no, she wasn't in a program. I said, she was in a commercial. So he said, what commercial? I said, Maxwell House Coffee. He said, we make that. I said, you make that commercial? He said, yeah. He said, that girl's not Brazilian. She's Indian. He said, she lives in the Fulham Road, which was about a mile away from where I was sitting. And I got her phone number off him. And then I phoned her, and she wouldn't go out with me. And then on the 11th night that I phoned her. And this is a very important thing that I thought about. I'd been married to this woman very happily, with a fabulous life for 47 years. And on that 11th night, I had said, if she doesn't go out with me, I'm not going to phone again. And that night, she came out with me, not because she wanted to. She couldn't get rid of me on the phone. She was going to get rid of me personally. But it didn't work out that way because we met and fell in love instantly at first sight.
I'm just curious about what you said on the phone. Like, hello, I'm...
No, I
saw you on TV.
Yeah, I just seen you in the commercial. You know, would you like to have some dinner this evening? Any restaurant in London you want and all that. And I picked her up in a Rolls Royce because I owned a Rolls Royce by that time.
Not bad for a guy who grew up poor.
No, exactly, yeah.
Your father worked at a fish market and your mother was a cleaning lady.
That's right, yeah.
What was it like growing up?
Well, it was fabulous because we were a happy family, which is the most important thing. We had just about enough money to be happy, you know, and to feed ourselves. Well, I didn't feed anybody. But I had a wonderful mother and a great father. But the thing was that from the age of 6 till 12, I never saw my father because he was in the army and he was away in the Second World War. And so I grew up with my mother and a brother, Stanley. And my mother was a wonderful woman. She said in one sentence, she made a man out of the two of us with one sentence. When my father went away, an army truck came and collected him. And he got in the truck and waved goodbye and it went round the corner. And I was 6 and my brother Stanley was 3. And my mother looked at us and she said, well, your dad's gone. Now you two have to look after me. And she made little men out of us in one sentence, which still stays with me. I look after everybody. It's amazing. It's one sentence and I was 6.
You think she just gave you that responsibility?
Oh, amazing. Yeah, yeah. I mean, without realizing it herself, really, she was just trying to make little men of us, which he did.
It's true that you didn't even have an indoor toilet when growing up?
No, what happened was we got bombed out in the war, and we were in the country, so it didn't hurt us. And it was amazing, bombed out, because if you go and see the building where I live now, it's still there. And they say, I thought Michael Caine said he got bombed out. This building's 100 years old. What it was, in the next street to us, a rocket dropped. You know, when the Germans had the rockets, they dropped. And they just obliterated a street. And they were silent. They weren't like the buzz bombs. And this, in Horseman Street, it was called. And I was there the other day, and it's just full of flats. There's no street left. There's just a sign. And what happened was when that rocket dropped on Horseman Street, it blew all our doors and windows out. It didn't hurt the building. It just blew all the doors and windows out, so we couldn't live in it. And they put us in what they used to call prefabricated houses. They were made of asbestos, and they came from Canada. They were made in Canada. And I was in this house, and you would say, oh, poor boy. This was the most fabulous house for me. For a start, we had a little garden. We'd never had a garden. And for the first time in my life, I lived in a house with electric light, central heating, a bathroom, and an indoor toilet, and hot water. And I'd never lived in a house like that. So for me, this prefab, which to everybody was a load of crap, was the height of luxury.
Of course, the war wasn't entirely a picnic for Michael Caine, whose name was actually Morris Micklewhite. More on that in a bit. But before the nice new prefab house, he was evacuated from London during the war and placed with a family that could have been the inspiration for Harry Potter's wicked relatives, the Dursleys.
The family used to go away for the weekend, and there was me and another boy called Clarence. I always remember Clarence was his name. And they used to lock us up on a Friday night in a room under the stairs and release us Monday morning when they came back from the weekend. And they used to leave us tins of open sardines and bottles of water. And that's what we lived on. And Clarence and I all came out in sores and everything, everywhere. My mother couldn't get down because the Germans were bombing the railway. And there was a time when she could. After about 3 weeks, we'd been evacuated. And she came down and found us, you know, and took us away. And she hit the woman so hard that she nearly went to prison herself when she met the woman. She really beat her up. And she nearly went to jail. But when the police saw me and Clarence, they forgave her.
What was it like in the cupboard?
Well, I suffer from incredible claustrophobia now. You know, I can't, you can't shut a door on me anywhere. I mean, it was just under the staircase. It was under the stairs. If you think of a staircase and a cupboard under the stairs and put two little boys in it, that's what it was.
And then you yourself went to war. And how did that shape you when you became an infantryman?
To me, I'm always disgusted by war. It's always started by men who are too old to go. That's the start. And then they send the young men who are too stupid to know what they're getting into, like me. And then you wind up in Korea with the American Marines, which is not a very good idea. No, I mean, it's the most terrifying ordeal that you can think of. And you have to do things that you would never think of doing. But there was one great advantage to me from the war, which was that we got into a situation on a patrol where we were surrounded by Chinese and we knew we were going to die. But what you worry about when you get into that situation, are you going to be a coward? Are you going to be yellow and run? And there were only four of us, a little tiny patrol. And we all said, well, we're going to make this as expensive as we possibly can, our deaths. And we were going to do that. And the officer said, let's go towards their lines and go right round. And so we went back. They were waiting for us to go back to our lines, the Chinese. And then we went back to the Chinese line and went right away round them and back. And so we survived it. We didn't have to do that. But I came out of it knowing that I wasn't a coward. And I've known that for the rest of my life. So for all the things I hated about Korea and the things I hate about war, which I do hate, I came out of it with one advantage, which fostered my one of my pet phrases is use the difficulty. And that's how I use that difficulty.
And how did you know that you wanted to be an actor?
Because I was an amateur actor in the youth club. I was, I went in for all the wrong reasons. I was in the basketball team, and I used to go up on the roof of the club to play basketball. And I always went past this door with some windows in it, and all the prettiest girls in the club were in there. And I said, what's that? Why are they all in there? And they said, it's the drama class. So I joined the drama class.
This was while you were in school.
Yeah, while I was...
So you were like 12?
I was 14. 14. There was a very beautiful girl I wanted to kiss. I thought, maybe I'll be in play with her and I'll have to kiss her, you know, because I was very shy with girls and all that. And I didn't know what to do. And so I joined the drama class. And I became absolutely... I was enthralled by drama and acting and everything.
Did you get to kiss that girl?
No, I didn't, no.
But what enthralled you about acting?
The first time I came on, and I got a laugh. And I thought that was funny. I hadn't said anything yet, and I didn't realise my flies were undone. And I always remembered that laugh, you know, I got. I was so happy to get the laugh, you know, it was fabulous. Getting laughs and controlling people, making people cry, doing that, being able to do that. When I think of people saying, I want to be rich and famous, I became an actor knowing absolutely, positively, that I would never be rich and famous.
Because? Yeah.
Because I had a thick Cockney accent, which in those days, no one wrote a part for anyone with a thick... You might be the policeman who comes in at the end and takes...
Well, what did it sound like? What did that... accent what? Then sound like?
My accent was like that. You talk like that. And you're all a bit higher. You're up here like that. Because they talk through their nose and that. But, of course, actors speak from the diaphragm because you have to reach the back of the theatre. But I was in Korea, in the war in Korea, and there's an incubation period for malaria, and I came home, and then I collapsed with malaria. And so there I was, I'm very, very thin. I lost a lot of weight, a slightly yellow complexion, and a thick Cockney accent. And I knew I would never be rich or famous. You absolutely knew that. And so I went into repertory for 9 years and learned how to be an actor in order to become the best possible actor I could become. Not the best possible actor, because there'll always be, whatever you do, people who are better or worse at what you do. I just started to be the best possible actor I could be, and that was the end of that.
You've said that you were always in competition, not with others, but yourself.
I was always in competition with myself. I would say to myself, you weren't as good today as you were yesterday. What went wrong? Why, with that scene, why weren't you better instead of worse, you know? And I'm my own judge, jury, prison and executioner.
Where did that drive come from?
Well, I think it just came from knowing that I was never going to be like Laurence Olivier or some people like that, or John Gielgud, you know, great theatre actors or big movie stars like Cary Grant and Robert Taylor and you know, John Mills in England or people like that. But I just decided to make myself the best that I could possibly make myself without any reference to anyone else.
You've done 150 movies. Do you remember the moment where you thought, I can do this? I'm pretty good at this acting thing.
Yeah. The first review I got for the Ipcress file, the first review I saw was very complimentary to me. And I thought, oh, my God, I've made it. Because the first time I ever played the lead in a movie was a picture called The Ipcress File, which was a spy story. I'd already been in a successful movie called Zulu, but I played a very posh officer in that. I didn't play anyone like me. And The Ipcress File, it was a sort of Cockney spy, you know. So it was more like the real me, you know. Not that I was ever a spy, but at least I was a Cockney.
Mr. Grantby, we are looking for an important piece of scientific equipment It was lost on a train. We think that you might be able to help us get it back.
Did you ever have stage fright?
Oh, blimey, yeah. Everyone has stage fright. In the repertory, we always had a bucket at the side just before you went on so you could throw up. It's true.
Did you ever use it?
Oh, blimey, yeah, constantly. I'm always nervous. I'm nervous. And I've noticed over the years, like working with actors in movies, you know, actors are not nervous and not very good. because they think that they can do it and they come across all wrong.
Michael Caine's also worked with many of the greatest actors of the past 50 years. The leading ladies alone who he's been married to on screen include Elizabeth Taylor, Glenda Jackson, Helen Mirren, Jane Fonda, and Maggie Smith. He's played a father figure to Leonardo DiCaprio, Nicole Kidman, Anne Hathaway, and Christian Bale. And then there are the actors who've played his buddies and his rivals, legions of them, each with his own particular approach to acting.
Yeah, you get funny ones. Like, I did a picture called Sleuth with Laurence Olivier, and we rehearsed it for 2 weeks because it was just the two of us. There's only two people in the movie. And he was mumbling, fumbling a bit the first week of rehearsals. He wasn't very impressive. The second week, he got to put a moustache on, stuck a moustache on his face. And he started acting, and it was brilliant. And it was, we were all stunned. It was the real Laurence Olivier, you know?
If I choose to say that my wife converses like a child of six and makes love like an extinct shellfish, I shall. And I don't need to ask her lover's permission to do so either.
Thank you for the drink.
Oh, no. I thought you were brought up in England. Surely you know it's not done to be rude.
You were being rude about a woman I'm in love with.
On the contrary, I was reminiscing about my wife.
It comes to the same thing.
Things mostly do, you know. I'll wager that in a year's time, it'll be you who'll be being rude about Marguerite and I who'll be being rhapsodic. I've quite forgotten how intolerably tiresome, vain, spendthrift, self-indulgent, and generally bloody crafty she really is.
We all said, that's fantastic. You wore a moustache and you... And he said to me, he said, I cannot act with my own face. He said, I can't do it. He said, and I tried. You saw me in the first week's rehearsal and it didn't work. But the other wonderful thing with Laurence Olivier, talking about a class system, like, I mean, I'm Cockney and all that. And, when I was going to do this picture with Laurence Olivier, before we started rehearsals, he sent me a letter. He was Lord Olivier. And he sent me a letter saying, it has occurred to me that you may be wondering how you should address me because of my title. He said, well, the moment we shake hands, I'll be Larry forever, which I thought was a great thing.
You were saying that Laurence Olivier needed the moustache or not to look like himself to really get into character. Is there anything you do to get into character?
It's always last minute. It's relaxation with me to get rid of the nerves and everything. The last thing I do before I go on set is I bend right over so that the blood goes to my brain and I remember the lines, you know? But I disappear into the character. And some actors, it's all tension and everything. I work out relaxation. I'm telling jokes and making people laugh right up until the last minute with the technicians, you know? And then I go right down to an absolute relaxed thing and I walk on and I'm the guy, whoever he is.
You've described acting as not acting, saying it's listening and reacting.
Exactly.
What do you mean?
Well, that's... I'll give you an example of that. When I was a young actor in repertory, I came very young, and I came on rehearsals, and I was playing a drunken man. And I came on, and then the producer said, just a minute, Michael, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm drunk in this scene. So he said, I know you're drunk in this scene. What are you doing? I said, well, I'm playing a drunk. He said, no, you're not. He said, you're playing an actor. I said, what are you talking about? He said, a drunk is a man who is trying to speak properly and walk straight. You're an actor who is trying to speak in a mumbled voice and walk crooked. And there he described movie acting to me in one sentence. And the same thing he did when I had a crying scene. He said, what are you doing? I said, I'm crying, blah, blah, blah. And he said, no, he said, what you're, he said, when a man cries, it's the last thing he wants to do. He said he would do anything but cry. He would stop himself crying, no matter how tragic it is. And he would do everything. And only when he's completely defeated emotionally will he start to cry properly. He said he would do anything but cry, a real man. He said, you are an actor who is trying to cry. Remember, and he described again, movie acting. That's a complete description of movie acting.
During the period Michael Caine's describing, when he was learning his craft doing repertory theater, he actually didn't go by Michael Caine, nor did he go by his birth name, Morris Micklewhite. He used yet a different name. I promised I'd get back to the story of how he got his screen name. Here's the whole tale.
Well, what happened was I came out of a repertory theater in the country, and I came to London, and I didn't have a telephone. And there was a club called the Art Theatre Club where all the out-of-work actors used to be in the bar, the coffee bar in the basement. And it was at Leicester Square, which is like Broadway in New York, all the big cinemas and theatres. And every night I used to go and phone my agent to see if there was a job at 6 o'clock in a phone booth on Leicester Square. And because my name was Micklewhite, I'd called myself, and I didn't want to use that name, in repertory I was called Michael White. And then one night I got a job, and the woman said, my agent, Josephine, said to me, she said, you've got to change your name because you've got to join Equity, the trade union. I said, yes. She said, and there is another Michael White in the trade union. So she said, you can call yourself Michael, but you can't call yourself White. She said, and I need a name now because I'm going to call a producer and I've got to say your name and tell him who's going to play the part. So he said, give me a surname. So I looked around the cinemas, and one of my favourite actors is Humphrey Bogart. And on the Odeon Leicester Square at that time was the Caine Mutiny with Humphrey Bogart. And I said, Michael Caine. He said, OK. He said, how do you spell it? I said, C-A-I-N-E, that's it. If I'd have gone to Leicester Square Theatre, I'd have been Michael 101 Dalmatians.
It's an incredible story. You were in your 30s, right?
Yeah.
When you became Michael Caine.
Yeah, 31. Yeah.
All the years of rep theater and the tiny, often uncredited parts in movies were for the love of acting. But they were about to pay off. When the ball started rolling, it did not stop.
It was just keep going at what I did. I tried to make myself better every day, and eventually someone noticed it, namely Cy Enfield, who was the director of Zulu. He saw me in a play, and my first play in the West End called Next Time I'll Sing to You. And I played a Cockney in that, and he wanted to cast me as a Cockney corporal. It was about the military, and I was going to be a Cockney corporal. And I went for the audition, and I didn't have a phone. And he said, I'm sorry, Michael. He said, we've cast a corporal, you know, but I couldn't call you. You don't have a phone. I said, no, I don't have a phone. So it was okay, because I've been turned down a lot of parts. And I was in a very long bar at the Prince of Wales Theatre in West End in London, a very long bar. And I always regard that long bar as the secret of my success, because if it had been shorter, I wouldn't be here. My film career might not have happened, because I got to the door, I was just opening it, and Cy Enfield said, come back here, he said. And I was cast as a Cockney corporal, you know, and he looked at me, and I was tall, skinny, blonde. He said, you look more like an officer to me, he said. You don't look like a corporal, you know, a corporal would be sort of tougher looking. So he said, can you do a posh accent? And I said, yeah. I said, I've been in repertory for 9 years, I've played hundreds of posh people. He said, do the accent, and I did it. And he cast me as the officer in Zulu, which started my career.
The film tells the story of an historic battle during the 1879 Anglo-Zulu War in South Africa. Michael Caine plays the haughty Lieutenant Bromhead, who is not happy to discover his superior is an engineer.
You giving me an order, old boy? Now, don't tell me. I suppose you have seniority. 1872, May.
1872, February.
Oh, well. I suppose there are such things as gifted amateurs. If I'm...
Are you questioning my right to command?
Oh, not your right, old boy. Never mind. We can cooperate, as they say.
Zulu's director, Cy Enfield, was an American living and working in England.
The thing about that was, thinking in terms of the British class system, if he had been an Englishman, that director, even if he'd been a left-wing communist, he would not have cast me as an officer, I promise you.
Chalk one up for the more class-fluid Americans.
And that was it. And the thing is, once you're on screen, you've either got screen presence or you haven't. And there's absolutely nothing you can do about it. I didn't know I had it. I didn't know whether or what it was. But it seemed that I had.
You think you're born with that?
Yeah. There are obviously actors who are much better than I am who never came across on screen. But and there you got actors who were terrible who came across on screen, you know. Not wonderful actors or anything, especially in Hollywood, you know, very handsome men like Robert Taylor and people like that. They weren't great actors, but they were big movie stars. John Wayne was a prop man on John Ford films, he told me once. He was a prop man on John Ford film, and he was big, you know, he was John Wayne. And John Ford wanted an extra guy. He said, can you ride a horse? He said, I can. He said, well, get on the horse. And he made him a cowboy, and he gave him a couple of lines, and he came across as John Wayne, you know.
John Wayne was actually the first big celebrity that Michael Caine met, he told Mary Jordan.
And he was exactly like I expected him to be. I was staying at the Beverly Hills Hotel, and I was there on my own because I was there to make a movie called Gambit with Shirley MacLaine. But she went over the schedule on what she was doing and didn't turn up. So nobody knew me in Hollywood, knew I was there except Shirley MacLaine and the producers and directors of the movie. And they left me in the hotel, and I used to sit in the lobby to look for famous people, film stars. And John Wayne came in one day and signed into the hotel. And then he saw me sitting there and he said to me, what's your name, kid? I said, Michael Caine. He said, you in that movie, Alfie? I said, yeah. He said, you're going to be a big star, kid. I said, well, thank you, Mr. Wayne. He said, but let me give you some advice. I said, what? He said, talk slow, and don't say too much. I said, thank you, sir. Thank you very much. He said, and I had on suede shoes. And he said to me, and never wear suede shoes. I said, what? He said, never wear suede shoes. I said, why not? He said, well, because remember, I just told you, you're going to be famous. He said, you'll be in the toilet taking a pee, and the guy next to you is going to go, Michael Caine, and he's going to pee all over your shoes, so never wear suede shoes. And that was my first meeting with famous.
Did you listen to his advice?
Oh, yeah, I threw the suede shoes away.
Where did you first meet Sean Connery?
What happened with Sean, how Sean got into show business, he was Mr. Edinburgh, he was a big weightlifter. And they were doing South Pacific, and there's a song in it called There's Nothing Like a Dame, sung by all these sailors, you know, big robust sailors. And they only had small chorus boys, you know, and it didn't look right, them singing this song, There's Nothing Like a Dame. So they went out to look for great big masculine men. And of course they went to weightlifting places and they found Sean. And Sean was in the chorus of South Pacific. And they opened on the Thursday. And on the Saturday night, there was a party to which I took two girls. And he came after the show late, about 11 o'clock. And he walked in and he saw me with two girls. And he walked straight up to me and introduced himself and took one of the girls. So that's how I met Sean Connery.
And did Sean Connery know who you were? Were you well
known? Oh, no, I wasn't anybody. No. I mean, that was before. We used to go do, I don't know what it's called in America, we call it the dole, when you get paid for out of work, when you're out of work.
Welfare,
yeah. We were on the welfare queue.
You and Sean Connery were in
the last time I was on a welfare queue, Sean was two men in front of me.
Were you in your 20s?
Yeah. what it was in those days, everybody I knew was not famous, and nobody I knew didn't become famous. It's like I had this friend called David Barron, who was an actor, and he said to me, he said, I'm gonna write a play and you're gonna be in it. I said, all right, David, you know. He said, I'm fed up with this, I'm gonna be a playwright. He said, David Barron's not my real name, I'm gonna write under my real name. I said, what's your real name, David? He said, Harold Pinter, you know. And I was in his first play at the Royal Court, called The Room. And you meet people like that. And the other actor I was with was John Osborne. He said, I'm going to write a play. And he said, I've nearly finished it. I said, what's it called? He said, Look Back in Anger. I went, oh, great, lovely. And it was time after time that you met people. Everyone I knew, Peter O'Toole, he was in the play. He became a movie star. I was his understudy. He became a massive star, you know. Albert Finney, Tom Courtney, they all became stars. And these were guys I knew. Terence Stamp, he became a star, you know. I shared a flat with him. And so it was one of those eras like that, you know, where everybody became someone. I remember once Richard Burton, you know. I said to him, I saw him in Hamlet when I was a young man. I lived near the Old Vic, the Elephant and Castle where I come from is near the Old Vic. And when I was a very young man, I went and saw him. But I was young, at about 21, 22. And I said to him, I said, when I got to know him later, because I did a picture with Elizabeth and she was married to Richard and I was talking to him. I said, I saw you years ago in Hamlet at the Old Vic. I said, the thing that struck me about it, I said, was that it was the fastest Hamlet I've ever seen. He said, you went, to be or not to be, that is a question whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer the seams and arrows of outrageous fortune. I said, it was so bloody fast. And he said, well, you have to remember, Michael, he said, the pub shut at 10:30 then. That's one of my, I did that so you'd hear my impersonation.
When you do it, when you have to learn an American accent, how long does that take and how do you do that?
Well, it's quite weird because you see, there's no such thing as American accent. There's about 50 of them, you know. And I did a movie, The Cider House Rules, and the dialogue coach said to me, can you do an American accent? You know, on the first day of rehearsal, I said, yes. He said, do it. So I did it. He said, it's very good, Michael. He said, but it's California. He said, this character's from New England. So I learned New England, which has very more English in it. You know what I mean? And I did it, and I got wonderful reviews for my accent in New England. I won the Academy Award for the part. And the British critics, because of the English it was in, it said, Michael Caine can't do an American accent.
Are you so stupid you imagine you're going to find a more gratifying life? What you will find is people like the poor people who get left here, only nobody takes care of them half as well. And you won't be able to take care of them either. There's no taking care of anybody. Not out there.
You know, I'm grateful for everything that you've done for me.
I don't need your gratitude.
You have such an unusual quality about you. What did the movie directors who see you in the camera say about you?
Well, I remember I was working with John Huston, who was one of my favourite directors. And I said to him, John, I said, you never give me any direction. And John Huston said, he said, you get paid a great deal of money to do this, Michael. You don't need me to tell you what to do. So I said, all right.
How has Hollywood changed?
It's gone from making movies about people to making movies about stuff and things like, including Batman, or Star Wars. It's no longer about ordinary people. Hollywood doesn't make Hollywood movies anymore. Everybody else does, including Netflix.
What would you call what Hollywood makes now?
Spectaculous. You get these movies that they come out and they make $1 billion and all that, you know, stuff like that.
Do you like them?
I don't see them.
But you're in them. You're in Batman.
I've seen Batman, yeah. But Batman was the least computerized, that's why people liked it, because the stunts and everything were real. The only time I remember doing any computer in Batman was Christian Bale and I. Christian Bale played Batman. And we did a scene. We had to have 6 million bats come on us. We had two bats, real bats, and they made them into 6 million with a computer. But stunts, I mean, I saw a guy do a 100-foot fall off a roof. That would have been done on a computer in most Hollywood films. He did it in real life.
And he survived. Mm. That's good.
With a big mattress.
Is there any actor that influenced you, maybe when you were younger, that you thought, wow, I see what he's doing there and I want to do that?
Oh, yeah, there were many. Humphrey Bogart, I loved. Cary Grant, I loved. Marlon Brando, especially because I was a method actor. I went to a theatre workshop in London, which is a sort of communist theatre workshop from Stanislavski in Russia. And so I'm a method actor, basically. And so Brando very impressed me, the hell out of me.
What's a method actor?
Sense memory. You go on sense memory for your emotions and you go back into yourself for the emotions. Like if I cry very easily and I have one incident that I go immediately to. And even my wife doesn't know what that incident is. And it's a real incident. And I've never told anybody, including my wife. We've been married 47 years and she's never asked me.
Do you want to tell us now?
No.
And do you have other things that you keep in mind if you want to be happy or joyous yeah. or proud?
Laughing is more difficult than crying, you know. And I go to situations that make me laugh, but I never tell anybody any of them. It's just a private thing. Cockneys are funny. Cockneys see the funny side of life because life is so tough. You have to see the funny side or you get miserable.
Is there some movie that you're especially glad that you made?
It was the happiest movie I ever made. It was called Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, with Steve Martin, and who was wonderful, and Glenn Headley, who was great. Glenn, as a woman, died of a heart attack at 51. You know, you don't connect heart attacks to women, let alone women of 51. And Glenn, I was so unhappy about that, but I had a wonderful time. We had a great time, the three of us. We were in my favourite place, the French Riviera. I had a villa they'd rented for me for the whole summer between two of my closest friends, Roger Moore, and the composer, Leslie Bricusse. And I had my family with me, my children, everybody, all the summer. And it was the happiest film I ever made.
I love to love you in the night.
I couldn't help overhearing your conversation in the dining car. My condolences to your grandmother.
Huh? Oh! Oh, right.
Didn't you say she was taken ill?
I tell them what they want to hear if it gets me what I want.
Rather a shabby trick, isn't it?
How much of success is luck and how much is hard work?
Oh, about 50-50. You've got to be lucky. I mean, timing is... I mean, I came along at a time when social life in England was changing and people were starting to write about working-class people. You know, movies were starting to be made about working. My first job when I came to London, I was an understudy for Peter O'Toole, who was in a play, and he became a star in the play, a fabulous actor. And he became a star in this play called The Long and the Short and the Tall, which was the first British play ever written about private soldiers in the British Army. I mean, and then, like, Bill Norton wrote Alfie, you know, about an ordinary English... John Osborne wrote Look Back in Anger. And they were the first playwrights to write about working-class people in Britain, I promise you.
And so it's timing, it's luck, and
it's
then...
Luck. Yeah.
What else?
And extremely hard work. You must work hard.
What's the hardest part about being an actor?
Learning the lines. It's the hardest part. It's so difficult to learn massive, long speeches. You know, any actor will tell you that it's a nightmare. And getting up at 6:30 in the morning, that's tough. I get up at 9 deliberately now just to prove I'm not working.
When you are working, even in your 80s, you're still learning and memorizing all these lines?
Oh, yeah. But the I don't forget the lines because I'm old, but what it does, it takes me 10 times longer to learn them. You know, I used to learn a page of dialogue. The director would say, oh, we've written a new page, learn that. And I'd go, yeah, all right, ready. Now I'd say, well, I'll come back next week.
You've won so many awards, including 2 Oscars. Have they made a difference in your life?
Well, they made me very happy. Oh, yeah, I was so proud when I won an Academy Award. But the first Academy Award, I wasn't there. I was making another dreadful movie, Jaws of Revenge. They said, will you do 2 weeks on Jaws of Revenge? I said, yes. And I'd made this picture with Woody Allen, and Woody was very anti-Oscars, you know, so you knew you'd never get nominated for Hannah and Her Sisters. So you knew you'd never get nominated for a Woody Allen picture. And so they did this movie at the time of the Oscars. I said, well, I'm not going to get nominated. And I did it, and of course I got nominated, and I won.
Were you shocked?
I was stunned. I was stunned that I got nominated, and I was stunned that I won it. But I was in Nassau making Jaws of Revenge, which everyone tells me was a terrible picture. But as I always say, I got paid a great deal of money. So I said, I never saw the movie, but I saw the house it bought my mother, and it was fabulous.
Your life is so improbable. You know, you were.
Oh, blimey, tell me about it, yeah. I regard myself as the luckiest man in the world.
Are you religious?
Yes, I am. But from a point of view of religions, my father was a Catholic, my mother was a Protestant. I was educated when I was evacuated because of London schooling by Jews, and I'm married to a Muslim. So I'm not, you know, but I do believe in God. And the only reason I believe in God is because I have to. And the reason of that is that if you've had my life, you'd have to believe in God. There was a very famous American boxer called Rocky Marciano, who wrote a book called Somebody Up There Likes Me. And if he hadn't used that title, I would have used it.
Instead, Michael Caine called his most recent book Blowing the Bloody Doors Off and Other Lessons in Life.
Well, that comes from a movie called The Italian Job, where we were doing, we were crooks and we were trying to steal some gold. And I had this explosive expert, and he'd put explosives on the door of the van where the gold was, and to blow the doors off so that we could get the gold inside. And when the explosion goes, the entire van and everything is blown into smithereens. And I look at him and I say, you're only supposed to blow the bloody doors off.
You're only supposed to blow the bloody doors off.
And that's where that title comes from.
Because it's a good line, or is it something to do with life?
It's something to do with life. It's the last line of the book, actually. It means go out there and get on with it.
You're only 85. What are you going to do next?
Whatever turns up, you know. I was offered a series on television yesterday, which I don't want to do. So I'll see what happens tomorrow.
That's Michael Caine speaking to Washington Post correspondent Mary Jordan for the Academy of Achievement. In addition to Blowing the Bloody Doors Off, Caine has 2 earlier memoirs about his storied life, What's It All About and The Elephant to Hollywood. And right now, he says, he's working on his first novel, a thriller. He won an Academy Award in 1987 for Hannah and Her Sisters, and another in 2000 for The Cider House Rules. That same year, he was knighted Sir Maurice Micklewhite at Buckingham Palace. He chose to use his birth name, he said, to honor his background. If you ever want to host your own Michael Caine Festival and binge watch every movie he ever made, just be forewarned. I did the math, and it'll take you about 12 and a half days watching 24/7. I'm Alice Winkler, and this is What It Takes from the Academy of Achievement. What It Takes is generously funded by the Katherine B. Reynolds Foundation. Thanks to them, and thanks to you for listening.